The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 22nd of August 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up, Russia decides to allow nuclear inspectors to visit Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear plant. Also ahead, an update from Canberra as Australia prepares to find out why former Prime Minister Scott Morrison secretly assumed other cabinet positions during the pandemic. Plus, denominated Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney refuses to rule out standing as an independent in the next US presidential election. And then Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco reviews the day's newspapers. Fernando, what have you seen?
Hello, Andrew. We have some encouraging news for the LGBT community in Singapore, plus the latest on foreign policy in Brazil.
All that coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Ukraine and Russia do not presently agree on much, but it might be hoped that they would agree, in their own interests and on behalf of humanity at large, on the desirability of keeping incoming ammunition away from Europe's largest nuclear plant. Russian troops seized the facility at Zaporizhia early in their current invasion of Ukraine, since when fighting has been intermittently too close to it for anyone's comfort. President Vladimir Putin of Russia now appears to agree that IAEA inspectors can travel to the plant via Ukraine and not, as he had previously insisted, via Russia. Well, I'm joined now by Sir Mark Lyle Grant, who served as the UK's ambassador to the United Nations between 2009 and 2015. Mark, welcome back to the show. Is there a sense, I guess, that we can be encouraged that Russia does appear to be taking this seriously?
Yes, I think it is encouraging news, Andrew, but we need to see what the timescale is, because it's still not clear to me anyway when the IAEA inspectors are going to be allowed into Zaporizhia, and also whether the Russians will try to sort of manipulate that visit, as we've seen many times before, for instance, when the Syrians manipulated visits by UN inspectors, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's early days, but it is encouraging that President Putin has said that he will allow these inspectors in.
I mean, is that a risk, do you think, that they will let the inspectors in, that they'll, you know, show them to a fairly harmless looking shed and not allow them to see anything else and then say, there you go, we let the inspectors in, what more do you want?
Well, as I say, that has happened in the past with other inspections to nuclear sites, both Iran and in Syria, for instance, when we're talking about chemical weapon sites. So I think, yes, there is a risk of that. On the other hand, the IAEA are very expert. They've made a lot of visits to nuclear stations around the world. I don't know whether they've been to Zaporizhia before, but probably have. And so it would be more difficult, I think, to pull the wool over their eyes. But there is a very disputed narrative about this nuclear plant at the moment, with Ukrainians saying that the Russians have hidden military vehicles and rocket launchers inside the site, with the Russians saying that the Ukrainians have been shelling the site. So I think any independent inspectors going there, even if they're not able to see everything, must be very valuable.
I mean, are we able, do you think, to bank on self-interest, both from Russia and Ukraine triumphing here? Because while any sort of accident or calamity at this nuclear plant would obviously be a disaster for Ukraine, you know, you don't need a long memory to recall a disaster at a nuclear plant in Ukraine also being a disaster for Russia.
I think so. I mean, one shouldn't compare necessarily this with Chernobyl. It is a more modern plant and it's much more secure as a result. It was built in the 1980s and therefore it's unlikely to cause a catastrophic meltdown as happened at Chernobyl if it was hit by a shell, for instance. But nonetheless, it is, of course, very dangerous and there is a risk of a nuclear accident, which wouldn't benefit either Russia or Ukraine. So, yes, there is perhaps a very small overlap of interest. But when two sides are bitterly at war with each other, one can't guarantee that overlap of interest will sustain for a very long period.
Well, on that thought, this war has been distinguished by at least one agreement between the two parties concerned, which is, of course, this agreement to allow some Ukrainian grain out of some Black Sea ports. Thinking in general terms, how difficult or unusual is that to get two countries at war to at least agree on something while the conflict is still going on?
It is unusual. I mean, there is always a degree of diplomacy going on during conflicts. And we've seen in this particular conflict agreements on exchange of prisoners, for instance. Mm. That's quite a common agreement during a live conflict. More unusual is this particular grain export deal. And I think the UN takes some credit for having negotiated that alongside Turkey. And I think the reason for that overlap of interest was that Russia was coming under pressure from some countries that might not be particularly hostile to Russia in the outside world, who had suffered hugely from the lack of grain exports from Ukraine. So although it's of more direct benefit to Ukraine that some of the wheat is now being exported, nonetheless, I think Russia realized that it was being blamed mainly for the fact that third world countries were suffering from a lack of food.
I mean, does it strike you as a diplomat that there is anything here that could conceivably be built on? Would you, if you were involved in these discussions or negotiations, be trying to, I guess, expand the parameters of consensus somewhat to take in, I don't know, humanitarian corridors, just anything that doesn't necessarily work against either of the two parties?
Yes, that is a sort of common method of conflict resolution. You start with some small measure of agreement and try and expand that outwards, or you start with a very short ceasefire and then try to extend the length of the ceasefire until it becomes permanent. But I think in this particular conflict, that is unlikely. Although, as I mentioned, there have been exchange of prisoners, there has been the grain deal, there is now this limited agreement for inspectors to go to Zaporizhia. I think the gap between the two sides on the core issue, which is Russia's invasion and seizure of certain territory in Ukraine, cannot be easily resolved. The gap is just too great for there to be meaningful peace talks at the moment. That does not mean that the Turks, the UN, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General in particular, you know, shouldn't keep trying to see whether there is any scope for wider peace talks. But at the moment, I don't see that happening. And the most likely outcome is that this conflict will go on for several more months at least.
So just as a final thought, then, if we are past the point, if indeed we were ever at it, where some sort of meaningful diplomatic solution to this was possible, are we now at the state where basically this war has to be won by somebody or seen to be won by somebody?
Not necessarily. No, I don't think it would be quite such a binary choice of winning or losing. A lot of conflicts don't end like that. A lot of conflicts end where both sides just get exhausted and therefore their objectives change and they decide that actually some form of peace agreement that saves face on both sides is better than continuing the conflict. I don't think we're at that stage yet. Neither side is completely exhausted. And I think the motivations, particularly on the Ukrainian side, to get rid of all Russian occupation of Ukraine is very great. And Putin's motivation, which is to prove himself as the great war leader and expanding Russian lands into their historical areas, you know, that the gap between those two motivations is too great at the moment.
Sir Mark Lyall Grant, thank you very much as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle 24's Emma Searle with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Police in Pakistan have charged the country's former Prime Minister, Imran Khan, under anti-terror laws. It follows Khan's claim that one of his closest political aides was tortured in police custody. His supporters have gathered outside his home and have said they will take action if Mr. Khan is detained by police. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has said he will release an official report into the behaviour of his predecessor Scott Morrison. It follows revelations that Morrison was secretly sworn into five ministries during his time in office. We'll have the latest from Canberra shortly. And millions of students in the Philippines have returned to school for the first time since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Classroom closures have been attributed to fears of the virus spreading rapidly in a country where it is common for children to live with their elderly relatives. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Emma. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, the failure of Republican Congresswoman and Donald Trump critic Liz Cheney to win re-nomination is certainly a battle lost in the fight for what remains of the GOP's soul, but it may yet be a step towards winning the war. There are suggestions that Cheney, presently vice chair of the Congressional Committee investigating Trump's attempted putsch of January 6th, 2021, may run for president in 2024, possibly as an independent. While she would have zero chance of winning the thing, a third-party candidate has not even won a state since 1968, when Alabama Governor George Wallace won five, she might win enough votes from relatively sane conservative voters to spike Trump or his successor in key swing states. Well, let's get some more on this with Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak. Chris, she would obviously, especially if running as an independent, be running as a spoiler. Could she win enough conservative votes to ruin things for Trump? Because when he won in 2016, it was incredibly close.
It was, of course, incredibly close. But I think it's the million-dollar question is where Liz Cheney's votes would come from. Clearly, she would be trying to run as a spoiler. When she lost the primary, she vowed to do whatever it takes to keep Donald Trump out of the Oval Office. So that would be her stand. That said, though, if you look at, for example, the 2020 race, most Republican never-Trumpers ended up voting for Joe Biden, say, voting for a Democrat for the first time. Liz Cheney, she is a conservative in every way, except for the fact that she opposes Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election result. But even that said, the question would be, you know, in that sense, would those who vote for her, would they really have voted for Donald Trump otherwise? Or might they have been tempted by the Democratic candidate if she were not in the race? Or would they simply abstain? So it's very hard to say what kind of impact she would actually have. That'll be the key question in the next couple of years as, heading into 2024. To see kind of where her support might come from.
Because the precedent I was thinking of was actually 2000, when, you know, Ralph Nader did not intend to deliver the White House to George W. Bush, but that was the effect he had. Certainly, if you just boil it all down to Florida, if you take the people who voted for Ralph Nader out of that column and assume half of them would have voted for Al Gore, then Gore is the president. The point being, you don't actually, if you're just running as a spoiler, you don't need to win that many votes in key states to stuff things up for one of the big candidates.
You don't, but that is still what the key question is. When it came to Ralph Nader in 2020, in 2000, they did polling afterwards where they found that about half of his voters would have abstained. And then of the others, yes, there would have been an advantage for Gore over Bush. But that simply is not as clear, I think, with Liz Cheney. If you were to ask people afterwards, you know, would you have voted for Trump if Liz Cheney were not there, or would you have voted for the Democrat, considering how many people passionately were anti-Trump, never, you know, Republicans who were never Trumpers in 2020. I'm just not sure that's the case. They might actually pull as many voters from the Democrats away as she would from Republicans. That's the key question.
Well, on that thought, do you have any bearing on how enthusiastic the Democratic Party would actually be by Liz Cheney running? Because rather curiously, in recent Republican primaries, the Democrats have actually been trying to sabotage sensible Republicans. They have this, I suspect, rather optimistic idea that the more outright dingbats end up as Republicans and Congress people, the better that will be for them. For example, they had been helping the Republican opponent of Peter Mayer, one of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump.
Yes, the Democrats have been playing a rather dangerous game, if you will, actually financing to some degree certain more extremist Republicans with the hopes that they can then defeat them in the November midterms. And Mitch McConnell from the Senate minority leader has actually suggested that that may have had some effects because he questioned the candidates that are currently up for Senate in the midterms this time around and sort of reducing the expectations for whether Republicans could take over the Senate again in the midterms this November. But that said, when it comes to the actual 2024 race, assuming Donald Trump is going to run, and it does seem most people close to him assume at this stage that he is going to run, you would have that extremist there, but somebody with a incredibly passionate group of supporters still. And therefore, whether Liz Cheney would be welcomed as somebody that actually benefits Democrats, I'm really not so sure.
It does seem weird that we are already talking about 2024 when we are not yet done with 2022, and nor has 2022 done with us, clearly. But the straws are already in the wind. The Iowa State Fair, quite recently, which, despite the name, is actually a pretty big deal in the annals of American politics. What did we learn from it?
The Iowa State Fair is always a big deal, given, as you said, that we are early at this stage, and particularly because on the Republican side, we do not know yet whether Donald Trump will run or not. He has not officially declared. What you saw in the last week at the Iowa State Fair was a number of these other potential candidates showing their face at the Iowa State Fair, talking up Chuck Grassley, who is the senator from Iowa who is up for re-election, pushing their own candidates, pushing the midterms and the message without sort of openly saying that they would run themselves. You had people like Ron DeSantis, Ted Cruz, both sort of very much Trump supporters, very, very openly supportive of Donald Trump, who would not necessarily run, say, if he were in the race. But then I should say you did also have some other more moderates, which does show the divide that still exists within the Republican Party. You had Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland. He was also at the Iowa State Fair. He is a very much a Trump critic, even more of a Trump critic than, say, Liz Cheney, because I suggested, Liz Cheney is sort of a one-issue Trump critic, if you will, when it comes to the 2020 election. Larry Hogan is an interesting moderate governor of a Democratic-leaning state of Maryland, and he's considering a run potentially in 2024, though the impact that he might have is quite limited. Mike Pence was also at the Iowa State Fair. Could he be considering, the former vice president, a run against his own president at the time? Of course, famously, the two do not get along that well after the 2020 election. We will see. Other people to look out for: Tim Scott of South Carolina, a senator, one of the few black senators from the Republican Party, or Nikki Haley, also former governor of South Carolina. All of them made appearances, are quietly sort of pushing their name out there in support of other candidates for the midterms, but it's a way for them to show a presence with everyone waiting to see what will happen with Donald Trump first.
Chris Chermak, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Tune in to Monocle on Culture, where we grill our panel of critics to get the inside line on the best in the world of film, music, art, literature and more.
It's just got this synth section that kind of makes you want to swing through the saloon doors straight to the dance floor.
I appreciate that some of the most brilliant art, most of it, grounds you in this moment and makes you confront it.
With industry insiders and the odd bit of reportage too, it's bound to keep the most discerning of culture vultures very well fed.
Why'd You Come In Here Looking Like That is a song that is absolutely going to make you want to put on a pair of tight jeans and go boot scooting, even if it's just in your front room.
Monocle on Culture. Culture, premiering Mondays at 20:00 London time here on Monocle 24 and available thereafter wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Now, since Australians learned that former Prime Minister Scott Morrison had, while in office, secretly helped himself to several other cabinet portfolios without telling anyone, including the pertinent ministers, the general reaction from current Prime Minister Anthony Albanese down has been one of bafflement. Why, in the wide world of sports, would anyone do this? We may be somewhat the wiser tomorrow when Albanese will release a report swiftly together by Australia's Solicitor General. Well, Karen Middleton is the Saturday Paper's chief political correspondent in Canberra. She joins me now. Karen, first of all, Anthony Albanese initially seemed as confused as everybody else by this. He did actually say, I think, at a press conference, you know, to anybody listening, if you figure this out, you tell me. Has he said anything since then?
Well, we heard from the Prime Minister today, Australian time, saying that he was expected to be briefed this afternoon on the advice from the Solicitor General. He'd asked the Solicitor General to advise him on whether or not any laws had been broken, either on the surface or underneath, in terms of what the potential implications were of having effectively two ministers authorised in the same portfolio at the same time, given that the Prime Minister took on these extra five jobs that you mentioned. So we only hear from the Solicitor General. Normally they wouldn't make public legal advice to the government like this. They're very reluctant to do that. They don't want to set a precedent. But the Prime Minister says there's a public expectation of trying to get to the bottom of this. So we're actually going to see the advice in full.
How has Scott Morrison defended it so far? And I guess more to the point, does anybody, including perhaps especially in his own party, seem to be buying it?
No is the answer to the last question. And yes, he has sought to defend it. He had a news conference last week, Wednesday of last week, that lasted for an hour, which was quite puzzling. It was full of sort of circular arguments. His initial argument is that he took on the health portfolio because of the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. We have a Biosecurity Act here that has some fairly wide-ranging powers that are only bestowed upon the health minister. So the former Prime Minister said he did that because what if something happened to the health minister? Then he took on the finance job as well, and that's where things started to get much more secretive. And then he took on the resources job and the Treasury and the Department of Home Affairs, which covers border protection, visas and the security agencies. So his initial argument was the pandemic, and then he said, well, also, what if one of my ministers made a decision that wasn't in the national interest, which made some of them flinch because that would suggest he didn't trust them to make a decent decision. So he dug himself in a little bit further with his explanations, and we're hoping that someone can make some sense of all of this soon.
I mean, Scott Morrison may be a bit demob happy at this point. I think those first few weeks after leaving office voluntarily or otherwise are probably a bit weird, but he spent quite a lot of the last few days actually joining in with a great deal of the online mirth that this discovery has generated. Are people cool about Scott Morrison, of all people, trying to find this funny and trying to make a joke of it?
Well, I think it depends who you talk to. Some people online thought it was very cool that he was sharing the memes around. Of course, the memes are all, you know, pictures of Scott Morrison doing everybody's job. I'm a hairdresser, Scott Morrison's doing my job. I'm a plumber, you know, I'm a shopkeeper, all of this. And he was commenting on the memes and I think even sharing some of them himself, which did seem to be a little bit odd to a lot of us watching politics. But as I said, we can't explain all of what he's been doing, so we can't explain this either.
Well, we will hear in detail from the Solicitor General tomorrow. But in the meantime, and you mentioned earlier that there'd been a fairly mirthless response to these revelations from the cabinet ministers whose jobs he had been helping himself to. But have we heard anything directly from his successor as leader of the Liberal Party, Peter Dutton?
Well, Peter Dutton initially was defending Scott Morrison, subsequently has changed his tone slightly and said that it's not something he would have done, and if he had been told about it, he would have advised the Prime Minister not to do it. Now, Peter Dutton had held the Home Affairs portfolio and had changed jobs himself into defence just before this Home Affairs by stealth took place. So, and there was a year between the first two of these portfolios being taken and then the rest of them. The first was in 2020 and then the later ones in 2021, which was in the lead up to our federal election, which was earlier this year. So Peter Dutton has said since then he doesn't, he doesn't think it was a good idea and that there are some questions to answer. But both he and the Prime Minister have spared the other person who's been questioned about all of this, and that's that, or his role has been questioned, and that's the Governor General who signed these commissions and also didn't make them public. And the Governor General has said that he wasn't made aware that it wasn't being communicated publicly. But there are some people who think that there should be more questions answered than that.
Karen Middleton in Canberra, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. This is The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Finally, on today's show, we will take a closer look at some of the day's newspapers with Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, we are starting, I believe, with the Straits Times in Singapore.
That's exactly where we're starting. It's good news for the LGBT community in Singapore, Andrew. I mean, not many people perhaps knew that, but Singapore will decriminalize gay sex. It's been a law since the colonial times, even though I don't think it was strictly enforced. Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong, he went to national television to say this is the right thing to do. It's a small step, but I think it is an important step nevertheless.
I mean, it's one of those things where you have to say, I guess, better late than never. Mm. But even though you say that they hadn't been exactly militant in enforcing it, which is true, but nonetheless, it's still quite a thing to have hanging over the head of a not insubstantial part of your population, isn't it? That, you know, this idea of people trying to live their lives while thinking who I happen to be is actually against the law of my country.
Exactly. And Andrew, it's funny because, of course, I'm framing this as a positive story, but I was reading more into it. And I think at the same time that this law is happening, they are changing a little bit the marriage law. So they're making sure that it's still very much a man and a woman. So for those that are thinking, okay, next step, gay marriage or civil partnerships, I don't think that will be the case in Singapore, at least for the next years. So, you know, as you rightly said, but, you know, it's been some welcoming news in Asia, because we see India, Taiwan, Thailand, in different ways, they've been kind of allowing more progressive laws when it comes to this topic.
Well, let's move along to a couple of stories from your particular neck of the woods. You want to talk about O Globo.
Yes, O Globo, a very interesting story here about foreign policy. So they're looking at the programs of both our main candidates for the election, Bolsonaro and Lula. There's been a change in the foreign policy for Bolsonaro, because when he was elected in a very anti-globalization platform. Mm. He even said before the election, saying, if I'm president, Brazil is out of the UN because I don't trust them. I mean, thankfully, we're still there. But now I think he basically is he's very pro-globalization. According to his new program, he said Brazil plays an important role in the world as a very diplomatic country. We don't have wars with many countries. So it's quite interesting to see that change, because clearly the anti-globalization didn't really work for him. And, you know, he offended so many world leaders. I think more recently he said something about France as well, which is an important economic partner of Brazil. Lula, on the other hand, I think he's continuing. When he was president, one of his main things is to basically cooperate with countries in Latin America and Africa. That was his priority.
That's your old school non-aligned movement variety foreign policy, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think we'll continue with that. But I think with Lula, yes. I mean, there was a very close attention, especially to Africa, which I find quite an interesting one. But you know, it doesn't mean that he's anti-US or Europe. He just wants to focus perhaps more on those two continents.
I mean, is it that idea perhaps of Brazil assuming what you could certainly see would be a natural leadership role for the global south, this absolutely enormous country in the southern hemisphere?
Absolutely. And I think we can play this role. I remember during the presidency of Lula, we opened many embassies in African countries that we never had an embassy before. Actually, it kind of reversed because at the same time, we closed many embassies recently, perhaps lack of money, but I think also not paying attention to those regions as well.
And finally, and I'm sure this is colossal news in Brazil. this is big stuff, isn't it? This is stop the presses, hold the front page, and it is.
Who cares about foreign policy, right, Andrew? I mean, it's the Panini sticker album. It's out now. And of course, the press is covering. I mean, they have a specific angle this year. For those who don't know, every 4 years, Panini released the sticker album with, you know, stickers for all, every single one of the World Cup players. There's 670 of them this year.
Are you an avid Panini collector?
I am, actually, since 1998 in the World Cup of France. But actually, Andrew, you kind of have to be rich now because the pack of stickers, they double the price. So it's more than inflation. So, for example, now in Brazil, you have to pay R$4. Just 10 years ago, it was 60p in Brazil. So there's been a huge rise, actually. But I'm sure people will still go and buy it as well. There's even some jokes, some Brazilian comedians saying, only if Neymar is naked in the sticker, I'll go and buy it. But, you know, that's just a joke there from the stickers.
We can only hope. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James. Our researcher was Tamsin Howard. Our studio manager was Callum McLean. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time. I'll be back with The Daily at 1800 London time later today. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.